From the earliest times, people have had some objective in view when they took to the religious life seriously. All sorts of causes make people turn to the religious life, generally speaking, away from, in opposition to, or in contrast with what is commonly called the worldly life. They seek peace of mind. They seek that which will make life in this world worthwhile living. They may seek the kingdom of heaven or nirvana. Or they may put it in this form, that they are earnest longing is to cross the ocean of samsara, to cross over this mundane existence and realize the divinity that lies embodied within them. Now, the oldest teachings with regard to the use of mantras comes in the Upanishads. There are extremely few people who take the trouble to study the Upanishads carefully. I mention this because, especially where the use of mantras is concerned, we are dealing with power, with energies. And unless we have real skill in the utilization of these energies, and unless we ourselves are rightly prepared instruments, the proper apparatus for the reception, utilization, and transmission of these energies, we will always suffer. Worse than that, we will bring trouble to those around us. This can never be overemphasized. We have the analogy in our physical existence. We can play with various energies, and a little mistake, and lo and behold, there's trouble. And where energies like, say, electricity or explosive chemicals are concerned, if those energies are wrongly handled, or we have some sort of accident because of our ignorance, or whatever the cause may be, or the apparatus was faulty, well, there is awful destruction. So we must bear this very carefully in mind. Now, the use of the word of power, the creative word, has come down through the Upanishads from the very beginning. It goes back even further than the times when the Upanishads were compiled. You mustn't think that the Upanishads belong just to a particular phase of history, or they had a beginning and you can fix a date, the 8th or 9th century BC or whatever it is. The teachings which are in the Upanishads, or the Aranyakas, or the Brahmanas, or the Vedas, the hymns, the Sanghitas as they are called, are all one original corpus of teaching, which arose probably amongst the Aryan-speaking peoples as well as the Semitic peoples way back into the dim past, at least 5,000 years ago, probably much more, maybe 7,000 or 8,000 years ago. The two great branches are represented in the original Kabbalah and in the original Veda. And both in the Kabbalah and in the Veda, there is that self-discipline for which the general name is yoga. Now, completely divest your minds of the idea that yoga immediately means physical postures. That is the least part of it. You see? Do understand, yoga means the way, the means by which the aspiration of the individual who suffers from all the consequences of isolative self-consciousness, of duality, and of conflict between the self and the not-self. Yoga is the means by which this conflict is removed, and there is the complete restoration of one's individual self into the wholeness, the holiness, which is the one total reality. Now, you can't do this merely by a set of physical exercises. You just can't. You can't do it under the excuse a healthy mind and a healthy body. Because if I approach it that way, that I am going to have a healthy body and then perhaps there's a good chance of having a healthy mind in it, I am still completely self-centered. And that precisely is the root of all the devilishness of the world. So whatsoever I do to improve the body increases the danger of my misuse of the body. Think very, very carefully. Look around. The people whose bodies are strong and healthy and all the rest of it, do they use them rightly? They use them fundamentally for self-indulgence. Whether that self-indulgence be of a gross and a bestial form, or whether it be in some sort of subtle form, sport or mountaineering or under the name of culture, wonderful art and all the rest of it. But look very, very carefully into it. It is self-centered. It is the effort of the individual to draw the world unto himself and box it up there. I am the great artist, the greatest, the wonderful that, and so forth. But this is the very root of the world's sorrow. Don't pray God to come to you if it means that you are going to be better off for it. And believe me, the Lord God will answer your prayer with ample tribulation. Because the Lord God is the first one who laid down, spare the rod and spoil the child. Make no mistake about it. So, we have to approach this as we have to approach any and every religious procedure in the spirit of complete unselfness. Do it because this is how it has to happen. Does a rose bush produce roses out of any self-consideration? It just happens. This is how it has to happen. That is all. There is happiness and beauty and spontaneity and the real zest of life. Now, until that real transformation in our inner consciousness takes place, until that takes place, and until our approach becomes the right approach, leave aside religion. Because the consequences of stimulating the energies and powers which belong to the religious sphere in our nature, which is the innermost and the most powerful in our mind, are far more terrible when they go wrong than any worldly energies. Now, let's come to this business of the mantra. You will find in several of the Upanishads, and especially in Upanishads like the Shandilya Upanishad, the question is asked by the disciple, or rather the request is made by the disciple, please teach me the various aspects of yoga. And in every case, first and foremost, the foundation is morality, utter purity of mind and heart. That's set out in detail. To be truthful, to be harmless, to cease to be self-indulgent, and all the rest of it, all that sort of thing is there. Then the second aspect is what is called the religious observances. Now here there is the first introduction of the idea of the repetition of the word, japa as it is called, a sacred word. And it has to be a sensible word, not a word whose meaning you don't know. This is the very the teachings of the Upanishads are the very contrary of what some try to put forward. Take any word, especially a word whose meaning you don't know. Well, then I can repeat to myself, idiot, 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 you see, and look for wisdom. Now, japa, the repetition of the word. Now, the word has to be repeated, not only aloud, but silently by the mind. And in the Shandilya Upanishad, you will find it said that the silent repetition in the mind is numberless times more effective than the repetition aloud. One is immediately reminded of Jesus with his disciples, and when ye pray, do not loudly yell out your prayers like the others, but pray in secret. And what is the meaning of the word secret in that context, which applies to japa? In the silence of the mind. See, this is very important. Now, we haven't got time tonight to sort of go into all its stages and aspects. Let us consider together, in the time at our disposal, the very heart of the whole thing, which is explained by the prince of yogis himself, Yajnavalkya, one of the greatest of the Upanishadic teachers, in the Tarasara Upanishad. Here, a disciple called Bharadvaja asks the question, and Yajnavalkya gives him the answer. In those days, the answer was never given to one who was not fit and had proved his worthiness to receive the instruction fit for that stage. In modern times, we can't do it because the times have changed, conditions are totally different. Supposing I was a Yajnavalkya, I can't pick and choose, this person's ready, that person's not ready, and so forth. The times have changed. And the way in which these things are put out to people has also changed from those old days. Today it is entirely by word of mouth, speech, and by the written word, which you can read and study. And you can discuss with somebody else and so forth, and practice by yourself. It was quite different in those days. But they are gone forever. They'll never come back. That was a totally different situation. Now, this is one of the supreme mantras which is used. Yajnavalkya says, Om Namo Narayanaya. Of course, they are Sanskrit words. Narayana is the name of the deity which is about the nearest correspondence to the Christian God conception at its finest level. The finest sort of theological presentation of the concept of God is the equivalent of Narayana. There are several names for God in Sanskrit, many, many names indeed. One other we shall use here, and that is Ishvara. Ishvara is God as power. The one who wills and lo there is. See? Now, Yajnavalkya explains the significance of this mantra. Now, this is where we have to attend very carefully. Om, you all know about. A-U-M, the mystic syllable. Om, Namo. Namo normally means salutation. Namaste, we say. You see, and Namo, Narayanaya, that's the dative case, unto Narayana. Well, is it just a salutation? Do we stop there? Do we just go on repeating like a gramophone, Om Namo Narayanaya, and lull ourselves, self-hypnotize ourselves into a pleasant condition? We can do that. And in that hypnotizing ourselves into a pleasant condition, we shall have opened the doors for inner mental energies, which energize the entire psyche, which energize our whole being, all the good aspects as well as the bad aspects equally. The devilishness in us is multiplied so x times, and so is the angelic part of us multiplied x times. We are no better off at the end, because this all lies within the sphere of ambivalence as we are. It's a relative state. Virtue, vice in conflict. Not real virtue. Virtue in its absolute sense. Now, Yajnavalkya explains that each syllable, there are 8 syllables in this, Om, Na, Mo, Na, Ra, Ya, Na, Ya. 8 syllables. Each syllable has its symbolic significance. Om is of the nature of Atma. Nama is of the nature of Prakruti. Narayanaya is of the nature of Parabrahman. Now, Atma. What do we understand by Atma? Naturally, those of us who have read the books will say, oh, Atma is the ultimate reality of Upanishadic teaching. It is the subjective term for the ultimate real, Brahman being the objective term. We may put it like that. What have we done thereby? We have said so many words. We believe we know its meaning. That means that we can utilize the terms Atma and Brahman logically in the sentences that we utter. But the sentences that we utter are completely restricted to ordinary ratiocinative intellectual processes. They are mere words. You and I don't know the Atma at all. To know God, to know transcendence, can any one of us say, I know God, I know transcendence? That statement would always be false, because no self-conscious I can possibly know that which transcends all self-consciousness, all limitation, all finitude. We can only use words which are negative rather than positive. And the negative words are used only suggestively in order to stir that something within the deeps of the mind which can transcend the limitations of finitude. This is the whole point. Now, I'll suggest a sentence, a long sentence, by which you, if you can remember it, and really work upon it, took me over 60 years of my life to create this sentence, ultimately. You might be able to get something out of it. When you yourself, utterly purified morally and mentally, completely still and silent, free of all desire, are the unresisting focus, empty and transparent in your own mind, for transcendence to flow in and out through you without any let or hindrance, then that is the meaning of the word Atma. You yourself, entirely purified, the mind entirely empty, transparent, fully awake, fully attentive, still and silent, then you are the center, the unresisting center, which is totally open to the inflow and outflow of transcendence itself. That is the meaning, the concrete meaning of the word Atma. This you won't find in the Upanishads, put in that form. But you look deeply into it, and you might find that there is something rich for you, for all your lifetime. So, the word Om is of the nature of that. Nama, that is of the nature of Prakruti. Prakruti is an easier word to deal with straight away. Prakruti is the word used first and foremost in the Sankhya philosophy of India for primordial nature. Now, do not limit your mind to conceiving of this in terms purely of what we commonly call the material universe. Because in the Sankhya philosophy, out of this Prakruti emerges the totality of the manifestation process, including mind and consciousness. You see? This is Prakruti. And it is called prakriti partly because this entire manifestation process, the becoming process, is one of perpetual change. It's only constancy. It's only unchanging character. It's only permanent character is its impermanence, its changefulness. This is prakriti. Whereas Atma, intellectually considered, is different. If you see with your third eye, if it is fully opened, there is no difference. All differentiation vanishes when you have the power of that inmost vision. And do remember, it is easy to be deceived by the intellect. I've been through it myself in my young days, since my young days. I thought I knew, oh yes, of course, there is no difference in this and that. Having said the words, I thought I had realized them. You realize in the innermost depths of consciousness. And if you're, in this case, not blessed, because you are blessed with the power of fluent speech, if you have that, you can easily deceive yourself that you know it, you are there. You're not. So you have to be very careful about this. So now this is prakriti. Narayana is of the nature of para brahman, that which is beyond brahman. Of course, now this is where we the use of words lands us into absurdities, because whatever words we use about brahman postulate brahman as the absolute, all, the ultimate, and all the rest of it. How can you have that which is beyond the absolute all? You can't do it. But if you spend many, many years meditating upon the sentences of the Sankhya Karika, the Sankhya philosophy and so forth, you will begin to sort of realize in your inner consciousness what could be the meaning of a word like Parabrahman. Sometimes we do have to use words which as such, under the scrutiny of strict logical intellect, are absurd. But they are not so absurd, really, when you meditate on them. So Narayana represents that which is the ultimate. It is of the nature. Now there is another consideration which we must look into. Each of these syllables produces something. Now this is the magic aspect of the mantra. A mantra is a spell. It's a word of power. And God said, let there be light, and there was light. Can you and I do that? If we could, we'd be totally free of our electricity bills and so forth. No. It's the word of power. And the word is not a sound produced by a human voice with a human brain behind it in this context. This is where we all get deceived, that if we go on saying, Om Namo Narayanaya, we feel grand and uplifted and we think we are levitating or cogitating or initiating, you see, tetatating maybe, you see. You must forgive me, I'm extremely merciless and critical about these matters, because you see, we suffer if we go on fooling ourselves. There's no value in fooling ourselves. The truth and the truth alone matters. Remember those wonderful words, and the truth shall make you free. You see? All right. So now, Om produces Brahma. Brahma is the first person of the Hindu Trinity, the Father God. Now, what is characteristic of the Father God? Creator, God the Creator. in all the religions of the world, whatever is regarded as the ultimate reality is ascribed creative power. That's about the first ascription we make to it. It's very interesting. All the religions are agreed on that. Right, so it produces Brahma. Now there is a physical correspondence to that, bodily correspondence. Brahma and what is called the knot, K-N-O-T, the knot of Brahma, the Brahma Granthi, is situated, now for those of you who have studied Kundalini Yoga and so forth, right at the base of the spine, and deals with the centers concerned there. The second person of the Trinity is at Anahata, Vishnu, the sustainer, the preserver. And Rudra, whose first meaning is the roarer, he roars. Rudra is Shiva, the third person. Originally called in the Rig Veda, Rudra, he's the roarer. And the significance of the roarer, I believe, is somewhat along these lines. That when a person really wakes up to a vision of the Supreme, he sort of raises a battle cry against evil. You see, this is his roar. We have in the Buddhist text the lion roar of the enlightened one, or of Sariputta, or whoever it is. This is the significance of it, that there comes forth this terrific energy, which is the announcement of the turning away from evil. And the turning away from evil is not a turning away from some external evil, but the supreme evil in my own being, that state of ignorance in which self and not self are in conflict. This is the roar. So Rudra is the roarer, and the ma produces Rudra, and the syllable na produces Vishnu. So you get Brahma, Vishnu, Rudra, or we'll say Shiva if you like. The whole of the Trinity produced by those first three syllables, Om, Nama, Om, Na, Ma. Then the five syllables of Narayanaya. Na gives rise to Ishvara, God as creative power. Ra gives rise to Virat, the Virat consciousness. Now, Virat is a word which is rather difficult to explain in detail. I won't go into it now because it will take far too long. But essentially, it is the Virat consciousness of the one total reality. This is how it is put, again symbolically. The Virat, it is the Virat consciousness of the one total reality which gives rise to the self-sense, I am. This is the important point to bear in mind. Gives rise to the I am. It's associated with ahankara, the I maker. Kara means maker, you see. And ya, the third syllable, produces Purusha. Now we have dealt with the word Purusha several times in past months and years, so I'll just very briefly recapitulate the fundamental and true meaning of Purusha. Purusha normally, if you look into a dictionary, is simply translated as person, a person. It simply does not mean person in our conception of the word person. The Brihadaranyaka Upanishad really gives out the secret of the real meaning of the word Purusha, the person. it is a strictly speaking, a footling piece of philology, nonsensical almost. But the Upanishadic teachers never hesitated to use a little bit of nonsense in order so to stimulate and impress the disciple that he began to see truth. Pu in Purusha is a syllable which belongs to the word purva, meaning before or formerly. And the ush part is derived from the Sanskrit root ush, U-S-H. You see, if you transliterate it. Ush, which means to burn. And the verse in the Brihadaranyaka says that because formerly he burnt up sarvam papmanam, all evil-mindedness. Practically every translator has translated all evils. I prefer to translate it in its fullness. It's not just papa. Papa is sin, ill, evil. But papmana is the evil mind. This is most significant. He who has completely burnt out all evil-mindedness is the person, the Purusha. So, the ya, na ra ya, produces Purusha. The na, the next na produces Bhagwan. Bhagwan is translated as Lord. Not Lord so much in the sense of controller or ruler. Not even, which is not inaccurate, but not even as protector, which is the first meaning of the English word Lord. He was the protector, just as the lady was the dispenser of bread. The Lord was the protector of those who were in his care. Not only in that sense, but bug, it's the bug part, which is the giver of good fortune. And please, nothing to do with worldly good fortune. You won't win football pools if you go on saying Bhagwan, Bhagwan, Bhagwan. You see? But the good fortune that you are awakening to the inner light, which will impel you towards the fulfillment of your true destiny in life, your own particular destiny, and the purpose of your existence as a human being, in general terms, on the face of the globe. This is the good fortune. So the Bhagwan is the Lord who is the giver of this good fortune to you. Mind you, these are all representations of what is inside our own nature. The whole story of religion is the story of your own mind and heart coming to fruition. Nature brings the body to maturity. It is our individual responsibility to bring the mind and heart to fruition, to maturity, so that we are whole and complete, and holiness is embodied in the living being. So, Bhagwan means that good fortune, the giver of good fortune, and the last syllable, ya, stands for the Param Atma, the beyond the Atma. Now you again have this Param coming in, Parabrahman and Paramatma, you see. But never mind, those old people knew a lot more, immensely more, than poor little folk like me do. Me does do. What's the correct? You see? So, Om Namo Narayanaya. is of the nature of Atma Prakruti Parabrahman, this, you can see, is on the macrocosmic scale, and produces Brahma, Brahma, Vishnu, Rudra, Ishvara, the I-sense, the Virat consciousness which gives rise to the I-sense, the Purusha, the completely purified one, one in whom evil-mindedness is completely burnt out, Bhagwan, the giver of the good fortune, and Paramatma again. So now, when you use this mantra, you are supposed, first of all, to enter into the real, deep, pure meditation, which has gone beyond the movement of speech and thought. You have to realize that state of silence first, the silence of the mind. That silence of the mind, because of which whatever sense impressions do come into you in meditation from outside, you see, are merely watched. Like a person sitting on the bank of a river, watching the river flowing past, himself unmoved, unmoving. Or you watch not merely the impressions that come outside, but the unworked out mental impressions which lie deep in the well of the unconscious within oneself. They are brought up, they are refloated into the light of consciousness. These impressions are the stuff of which the old people said they are the substrate for rebirth. The word used is jati, you see, but I totally reject the word rebirth because it gives a false picture of what actually happens. Quite a false picture. I translate the word jati in its secondary meaning, the conditioned state. The word birth or rebirth is regarded as a primary meaning, but there is also another primary meaning of jati. And it is used in ordinary, in its ordinary social significance. What social group do you belong to? Are you a dustman? Are you a duke? Are you a whatever it is? That's your jati. What clan? Are you a MacPherson or a MacAllister or what? This is your jati. Your jat. And jati is the conditioned state. And it is this which has been missed out, and the importance and significance of this. Now these conditioned states are innumerable within our lifetime. Every state in which we find ourselves confined to limitation, to discriminative consciousness, to the time sense, to the conflict which inevitably is present because of the ambivalent functioning of our minds, these are the innumerable jatis. And when you are able to enter into the profound states of consciousness, which enable you to look back, as we say, into your past, it's not past lives in the reincarnational sense that you look back into, but it is by this, what the psychologists in a fragmentary way have discovered, this association technique. You go back like this. But remember that the association technique as used by the psychologist, the professional psychologist, is used by one who has not become a Purusha, one in whom all evil-mindedness is burnt out. Therefore, the activity within the deeps of his consciousness and his mind, which inevitably goes on, however objective he tries to remain, is reacting back upon the patient. We won't go into that because that's a big field. But here was something quite different. In this purified state, now you call out from the well of the unconscious what has not been worked out, and it is solved forever and ever. It's the end of the thing. All the vasanas, as they are called, that is these unworked out mental impressions, are burnt up, so to say. But the burning up is not a destruction. It is a transformation, because the energy locked up there is liberated as pure energy in you, psychical energy. This psychical energy enables you to have that tremendous stamina by which you can sit through long meditations. 1, 2, 3, up to 7 days, if you like. These are actual facts. Unless the Buddha was indulging in a terminological inexactitude, he said quite openly and simply to a group of Jains who came to discuss with him, he said, "I can sit in this state of happiness," he called it sukha, the state of bliss, as the Upanishads would put it, "for one night and one day, 2 nights and 2 days, and he goes on up to 7. Without moving. Now think of the significance of that. What sort of a discipline did he go through in order to arrive at that condition, where for 7 days and nights, unmoving, he could stay in meditation and enjoy bliss? I'm using the English words enjoy bliss, but, oh, they are so inadequate. If you ever have the slightest touch of transcendence through you, and you realize this out of this world poise and plenitude and power, you will begin to have some sort of dim glimmer of what that bliss is like. So now, Om Namo Narayanaya. You have to enter into this meditation, be in that state, and with every syllable you conjure up the psycho-spiritual power, I should say psycho-mental spiritual power, which has its correspondence with the actual power of the physical body, its electrochemical energies, which produces results which nobody ever talks about. You remember St. Paul saying, writing in Corinthians, he knew a man in Christ, he was talking of himself, taken up into the third heaven, etc. And so on, he goes on saying that, and then he says, and he heard things which it is not lawful for man to utter. Heard things, not with the ears. They weren't words. They weren't thoughts. They weren't the product of what we commonly call intellectual activity. All this belongs to this world of mortality. But there is that transcendent reality. And it is that transcendent reality that comes through unhindered in the one who is a completely purified vessel. Now, he can use the mantra. This is a bit terrible in a way, isn't it? You remember, time and again I've said, only he who has gone past the need of reading the scriptures may read the scriptures with profit. The scriptures utter truth in such a way that it escapes our ordinary ratiocinative intellectual activities. at the root of it all, and I've said this thousands of times now, you'll be tired of hearing me say it, at the root of it, there is the indispensability of purity. The purity of the heart and of the mind. The heart means morality as we ordinarily know it. Truthfulness, loving kindness, and all the rest of it. Everyone knows that in so many words. But the purity of the mind means the complete freedom from all bias, prejudice, all preconceptions, all ideas, all beliefs, all convictions, all assumptions, none of which have any warrant in the context of transcendent reality. They have warrant in our ambivalent sphere of duality, of conflict, of misery and ill, but they have absolutely no meaning in terms of transcendent reality. So it is like that. When you are beyond the need of mantras, then you can play about with them and enjoy them. You know, there is a, and I believe there is a play based on it. In India, there is a picture or image of the Lord, the embodied Lord of the universe, Sri Krishna. You know, we say Jesus was the Son of God. But in India, of Krishna, they say Krishna was God himself, you see. And there is a picture. He's seated on a throne with his eyes half closed, with a blissful expression on it. One hand is inside a roaring fire, a real blaze. And the other arm is round a gopi, and his hand rests on her breast, you see. Work out the significance of that. There was one of the great sages, I forget the name, I'm sorry. But I can't remember everything read over 60 years, in which the sage, the seer, who has at last realized transcendence, says, "Oh, now, bring me wine, women, song." Makes no difference. Not meaning that he will indulge in it, far from it. He becomes totally incapable of any such indulgence. He is the seer, one with the total reality, and he sees this play on the stage of the becoming process and remains the utterly holy one, the utterly pure one. If we bear this in mind, the essentiality of purity to start with, and then really deep study, deep consideration, the practice of meditation in the right way. This is so difficult, the right way. Not merely the routines laid down for me to climb the rungs of a ladder which goes up to heaven. None of all that nonsense. Meditation in the right way. Because it is the natural thing that has to happen. See? Then, Om Namo Narayanaya. And you will be a wielder of supreme spiritual power. Or of any mantra.